From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the forgotten First Lady, Florence Harding. Carl Sferrazza Anthony has just written a biography of Harding, detailing her unconventional life, the scandals associated with her husband's administration, and her accomplishments as a modern First Lady. Later, we'll talk with Sarah Kelly about the transition from production assistant to director. Her new film is a documentary called Full Tilt Boogie, a funny behind-the-scenes look at the making of the campy vampire western From Dusk Till Dawn, starring Quentin Tarantino and George Clooney. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews The Fall of a Sparrow, a new novel by Robert Hellinga. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A House committee is meeting at this hour to decide whether to cite Attorney General Janet Reno for contempt of Congress. Reno has refused to turn over a report recommending that she seek an independent counsel to look into alleged campaign fundraising abuses. Republican Dan Burton, chairman of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, said as the panel convened today, Reno must comply.
I've been willing to reach a middle ground. Our committee has been willing to reach a middle ground. However, in conversations between my staff and the attorney generals, there hasn't been any sign of movement whatsoever on their part.
Reno has refused to release the memo, saying it would jeopardize a continuing investigation. 6 months after she came to the attention of the public, Monica Lewinsky arrived this morning at a federal courthouse in Washington to testify before a grand jury about any relationship she may have had with President Clinton. Independent counsel Kenneth Starr is investigating allegations that the president had a sexual relationship with a former White House intern and asked her to lie about it. The grandparents of one of the two girls believed to have been switched at birth at the University of Virginia Medical Center have agreed to allow genetic testing on their granddaughter. The tests are to determine if the girl is their blood relative. Jim Davis with member station WVTF reports from Roanoke, Virginia.
The grandparents of 3-year-old Rebecca Chittum had previously refused to agree to allow genetic tests on the child. An attorney representing the family members says they changed their minds and agreed to allow the test in the hope the results will bring closure to the uncertainty of their situation. Rebecca's parents died in a car accident last month, just one day after another Western Virginia woman learned the baby she has raised for more than 3 years is not her biological child. Officials at the University of Virginia Medical Center say they believe the children were switched while their mothers were in the hospital for their deliveries in 1995. An investigation is continuing. For NPR News, I'm Jim Davis in Roanoke, Virginia.
Authorities in North Carolina have captured a suspected killer. Police say James Finley was fascinated with another fugitive. Scott Jagow of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
It turns out 21-year-old James Finley Jr. could not elude the law as well as he thought he could. Authorities nabbed Finley last night after less than 2 days of scouring a heavily wooded area in central North Carolina. The Hickory man is charged with Sunday's murders of two Charlotte-area campers about 120 miles to the west. Before the killings, his family said Finley had closely been following the manhunt for Rudolph and had bragged he could avoid capture just like the clinic bombing suspect. Finley was armed with a rifle and a handgun when he was confronted, but was taken into custody without incident. Meanwhile, in far western North Carolina, the massive search continues for Rudolph, who has eluded arrest for more than 6 months. For NPR News, I'm Scott Jagow in Charlotte.
On Wall Street this hour, the Dow is down 21 points, the Nasdaq is up 17. This is National Public Radio News. In NPR's business update, it's looking like more rough going on Wall Street today on the heels of Tuesday's nearly 300-point drop and yesterday's move back into positive territory. The market remains volatile. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
After several days of mood swings, the stock market apparently isn't ready to calm down just yet. The Dow continues to bounce around as analysts pore over quarterly earnings, which they say in some cases just doesn't justify the prices being paid for companies' stocks. Stock in Pioneer Group, a money management firm, fell after the company said it won't pay a quarterly dividend and reported a second quarter loss of 48 cents a share. Stock in managed care provider United Healthcare is also lower today on bad earnings news. News was somewhat better, however, for women's clothing retailers Ann Taylor and Talbots, both of which are predicting higher earnings. Factory orders rose in June. They were up 0.1%, according to the Commerce Department. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. consumers continue their spending spree. The nation's largest retailers reported strong sales last month for the seventh month in a row. The bestsellers in July were clothing, back-to-school items, and products for the home, such as appliances, furniture, and accessories such as lamps and pillows. The stores that did the best were the big discount retail chains such as Walmart and Kmart. Ballpark Franks issued a press release today modestly proclaiming the company is making hot dog history. It's coming out with single-serving hot dogs, each wrapped and already vented and ready for the microwave plastic to cook in 20 seconds. The press release quoted Ernestine Benford, the director of new business development for Ballpark, as saying this is one of the biggest innovations to ever hit the hot dog industry. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 20 points and the Nasdaq is up 17. I'm Nora Brahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. First ladies have played many roles through history, from presidential helpmate to outspoken activist. My guest, Carl Sferrazza Anthony, says that recent activist first ladies, such as Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton, owe a debt to Florence Harding, whom he considers the first modern first lady. He details her accomplishments in his new book, Florence Harding, The First Lady, The Jazz Age, and The Death of America's Most Scandalous President. She was married to Warren G. Harding, whose administration was plagued with corruption, cronyism, and an oil leasing scandal, which came to be known as Teapot Dome. Harding is now considered one of the worst presidents in this country's history. I asked Anthony why it's taken so long for history to recognize the contributions of Florence Harding.
Well, I think there's a few reasons why she was forgotten. Number one, good history is unfortunately good public relations. And if you have people of a particular political persuasion writing that history and you're not around to counteract it, sometimes your reputation goes down the tubes. And Florence died 15 months after the president. A lot of her friends were in the thick of the really horrific scandals of the Harding administration, and I think because she had an interest in astrology and the supernatural, because she was married to this man who was been consistently rated the worst president, she's never been given any serious consideration on her own. She's always just been sort of this hatchet-faced caricature. And then contrasted with these young and very attractive sort of flappers who were Harding's assorted mistresses, Mrs. Harding in her Marcel Wave and pinched-nez glasses seems like a visually grim contrast.
You call Florence Harding really the first modern first lady. And reading about her accomplishments and reading about her interest in turning this office of first lady into something more than just cosmetics. I was very surprised, frankly, to read about what she brought to this office. Give us a sense for the various firsts associated with her.
I'm so happy you touch on that, because it is fascinating. She really saw an opportunity to use this position and turn it sort of back towards the people who had put her there. First of all, she was very grateful for the opportunity. And in a way, becoming First Lady opened her heart. And she very consciously wanted to make both herself in a real and physical way, as well as a symbol, and the mansion itself more accessible to the public. So that meant literally opening the gates, which had been closed during the Wilson years, allowing streams of tourists to come in. The house and the grounds were used, the grounds were used as a public park. The house was open to the tourists again. She often led tours. She actually touched people with her hand. She didn't wear white gloves and hold herself back with a little bouquet. She backslapped. She hugged. She clasped people's hands. And she asked them what was on their mind. She asked them about problems they were facing in their community. And she had, from the get-go, announced her commitment as an activist to the disabled veterans of the First World War.
Was she a popular first lady because of this?
She was an extraordinarily popular first lady. And this is what's really fascinating, because here you have just a few years before Edith Wilson being derided on the floor of Congress for running a, quote, petticoat government, as she managed, in a sense, the presidency rather secretly and furtively while her husband, President Wilson, suffered from his stroke. And then just 2 years later, you have Florence Harding talking publicly about how she was going to see to it that women were appointed to high federal positions, how she was going to lead a national boycott of women against the high price of sugar, how she was going to lobby Congress for the first federal reformatory prison exclusively for women, and how she was going to act as an investigator on behalf of hundreds of cases of veterans who had sort of fallen through the cracks of the system. And editorials praise her, and people praise her, and she is said to symbolize the new woman. And this, of course, is the spirit of the post-suffrage era.
She had a lot of power, as I understand it. She had the power and oftentimes made suggestions for appointments. She edited her husband's State of the Union addresses and other speeches that he gave. She even made decisions on which prisoners got paroled. This seems like an extraordinary amount of power for a first lady.
It does, but it gets back to that timeless issue of, you know, the boss's wife, and we've gone through it in varying degrees and in varying generations with Eleanor Roosevelt and Nancy Reagan and Hillary Clinton and Rosalynn Carter, and even a little bit with Abigail Adams publicly and Mary Todd Lincoln. And we'll probably continue to go through it, and we'll go through it when we have our first gentleman.
She acquired the services, or actually hired on an astrologer, someone who would help her, I guess, what, consult with her, read the future for her. She believed in the supernatural?
Absolutely believed in it. And I think when one considers the fact that she lived with death very closely every day, she had a chronic kidney ailment, which, although it did not leave her an invalid, certainly made her condition, her health, rather precarious, because at a moment's notice, if this condition flared up, her kidney could block and her system fill with uremic poisoning. I think this had a great effect on her, wanting to have a sense of control over the uncontrollable. And ever since her childhood, when her father used to take her out into sort of the bucolic countryside of outside of Marion, Ohio, where he would collect rents from the old German tenant farmers on his property, she would see the hex signs on their barns or the witch's ball in the kitchen window to keep evil spirits away. And so it was a lifelong fascination.
Did this astrologer have a lot of power in the White House?
The astrologer's name was Madame Marcia, and she and it was reported at the time. And, in fact, letters of Mrs. Harding to the reporter were printed, and Mrs. Harding didn't seek to deny that. She consulted Marcia. The astrologer advised the First Lady on appearances that the president should or should not make, good days to meet with different kinds of people. And then as the political scandals of Teapot Dome and the Veterans Bureau began to break, the First Lady then gave her the readings to be done rather belatedly on cabinet members and advisors and whether they could be trusted.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Carl Sferrazza Anthony. And we're talking about his new book. It's a biography of Florence Harding. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carl Sferrazza Anthony, and his new book is a biography of Florence Harding, the wife of President Warren G. Harding. When she married Warren G. Harding, she knew about his reputation as a womanizer, and he certainly didn't do anything to curtail his interests and his activities, which continued into the White House. How much was this public knowledge?
Well, many members of the opposition party, the Democrats, knew it, and several reporters knew it. Specifically, they knew about Grace Cross, who was his Senate secretary, and they knew about his long-term relationship with Carrie Fulton Phillips back in Marion, Ohio. Most people, I found no evidence that anyone really knew much about Nan Britton, the more famous of his mistresses at the time he was in the White House.
And Nan Britton claimed to have had a child with Warren Harding. She wrote a book about it, I believe shortly after he died, called The Presidential Daughter. What evidence is there that this child is indeed the child of Warren G. Harding?
Well, there's various forms of corroborative evidence that I have found that in the Harding papers themselves, actually, that give credence to Nan Britton's general story. A letter, for example, by a young woman by the name of Louise Biederhaus, who wrote to Harding saying, "Oh, I'm so happy to vote for you. I don't know if you remember, but we met at the typing class at the YWCA through our mutual friend Nan Britton." And Nan, of course, had written about this in her book, this meeting that taking him to the typing class. George Christian, President Harding's secretary, also told people privately that Nan Britton was telling the truth, that this was a relationship, and George would know because he kept the letters and the photographs carefully separated from other materials in the president's desk. So there's confirmation on the general outlines of Nan's relationship with Harding. Now, the fathering of the child, no DNA testing.
Yeah.
We don't know.
You don't know.
We don't know.
Were there Oval Office trysts?
There was, according to Nan Britton, a regular meeting with the president in a small closet in which an old leather couch would fit, which was connected to the Oval Office. This was corroborated by Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who learned about this incident from Ike Hoover, who was the chief usher of the White House. But some people still feel that Nan was not telling the truth and don't want to believe it, but there are various memoirs of White House staff people that confirm it.
What did the Republican Party and its officials do to deal with Harding's womanizing? And I know some of these women really tried to blackmail him and use their relationship with him to get money for themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, a lot of these women were very demanding on Harding, I mean, for money and gifts and things. It seems to be a pattern with him. Carrie Phillips was the most incessant and the most successful. She demanded $25,000, and in this book, published for the first time, is Harding's capitulation letter to her demands for blackmail. He says he cannot personally raise the amount, and he asks her to hold off a little bit. He writes this in April 1920 until the convention, knowing, as did Florence, that if he's nominated as the Republican National candidate for president, that the Republican National Committee can raise the blackmail, and that is indeed what is done under the auspices of its chairman, Albert Lasker.
Well, it's certainly interesting to read about these scandals associated with the Harding White House and compare them to the accusations today aimed at the Clinton White House. What parallels do you see?
Well, I have to be very honest with you, and I know this is a disappointing answer for some people in the press. I don't see a lot of the parallels because looking at it from the point of view of today with Harding, we have some real documentation. We have affidavits that were prepared for Grace Cross. We have Harding's capitulation letters to Carrie Phillips and Secret Code. We have reports from others who were keeping tabs on Harding. We have the recollections of a reporter, Bertha Martin, and Evelyn McLean, a good friend of the Hardings, who really spilled the beans. We don't have that right now in the case of President Clinton. We have a lot of very detailed allegations. Now, I do see a comparison between Florence Harding and Hillary Clinton in that I see them both as part of a continuum with Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosalynn Carter, to a certain degree Betty Ford and Nancy Reagan as well, women who had the courage to either publicly speak up on issues that were important to them despite whatever criticism might ensue, or women who behind the scenes were taking a very active role in the presidency.
But it is interesting to read about Harding and to read about these stories about his own personal life and to compare that to the stories, whether true or not, that are coming out day by day associated with the Clinton White House, that what's in the history books, which oftentimes gets muted over time, seems much more scandalous when it's in the current day news.
Well, I'll tell you what to me is the most interesting thing about all this is that with Harding, again, a Republican, the Democrats knew. I mean, people, the top leaders of the Democratic National Committee, including also President Wilson and his cabinet, knew, for example, about Grace Cross. And one of them, former Wilson Attorney General Mitchell Palmer, used the FBI to harass this woman, Grace, out of Washington during the campaign, blunting her effort to also blackmail then presidential candidate Warren Harding. And then later, after Harding is elected, these Democratic officials come to the president to ask that a prosecution be dropped against, in this case, Mitchell Palmer, based on the fact that they had gotten rid of Grace Cross. And Harding complies. And some of the reporters knew about it. So it's you have the press, the Democrats, and the Republicans all in cahoots with each other.
Well, let's complete the life of Florence and Warren G. Harding. He died on a sort of under mysterious circumstances on a trip to Alaska, and this is back in 1923. Died suddenly and with some degree of mystery. What were the circumstances?
Well, it's exactly 75 years ago. Right now, he died on August 2nd. And for the week after that, the whole country was focused on this funeral train that was coming slowly back from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. Tens of thousands of Americans lining the train tracks and waiting for hours to get a glimpse of this. And by that point, the rumors had already started that Florence had poisoned the president. And what, in fact, had happened was that he had a very serious heart condition. He then had some crabs and had a touch of ptomaine poisoning, as did several others in the party traveling with him. They, however, recovered within a few days. Harding continued to complain of what he called indigestion. This Rasputin-like figure to the First Lady, a little homeopath by the name of Doc Sawyer, who had literally pulled her from what was a near-death experience in even the words of 1922, just several months before that. Mrs. Harding gives her tacit and complete support and approval of everything Dr. Sawyer does. Mm-hmm. And Sawyer begins treating Harding with heavy dosages of purgatives to flush these perceived poisons out of his system. Harding continues to complain of indigestion. The number two doctor, naval physician Joel Boone, keeping very assiduous notes on all this, is alarmed when he, without Sawyer's knowledge, examines the president's heart and finds it alarmingly enlarged. Mm. On the night of August 2nd, in the Palace Hotel, Sawyer gives Harding one more purgative while Boone is out of the room. Harding expires, collapses. Florence is in the room alone with him, thinking he's just fainted. Sawyer runs out to get what's called a restorative. Florence is alone in the room and realizes he's dead, comes out in the hall and screams for the other doctor and Boone, the genesis of this legend that she was in cahoots with Doc Sawyer and that she killed the president.
Was there any effort at a cover-up, considering some of the murky circumstances of his death?
There was an extraordinary cover-up. Not only was the First Lady an unwitting accomplice to a negligent homicide, she was part of a very careful and conscious conspiracy to cover up the details of his death, the medical incompetence, which would have not only embarrassed Sawyer, but some of the other consulting physicians, as well as the First Lady herself, who publicly would introduce this man as the man who can keep me alive. She refused to permit an autopsy. He refused to sign Doc Sawyer the death certificate, and she had the body brought back to Washington. And she said a lot of strange things, you know, at the time of his death. She would bring people over to the corpse and say he was magnificent in life. He was beautiful in life, but he is more magnificent still in death. Mm-hmm. And when at 2 o'clock in the morning, heavily veiled, wearing her diamond, along with Evelyn McLean in the East Room in this hot, muggy night, with all these flowers, this cloying smell of flowers in the East Room, she raised the top of the coffin, and she began this two-hour monologue with the president. And she ended by saying, "The trip hasn't hurt you a bit. No one can hurt you now, Warren." And then turned to Evelyn and said, "Now that it's all over, I'm beginning to think it was all for the best."
Whoa.
So.
Pretty provocative.
Very provocative.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Carl Sferrazza Anthony is the author of Florence Harding, The First Lady, The Jazz Age, and The Death of America's Most Scandalous President. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Full Tilt Boogie. That's a new documentary from first-time director Sarah Kelly. It's a comic look at the making of the vampire film From Dusk Till Dawn, starring Quentin Tarantino and George Clooney. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Fall of a Sparrow, a new novel by Robert Hellinga.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Every production assistant on a movie set has fantasies about being a director, about taking all that accumulated knowledge and experience and putting it to work, about being the person who is served coffee instead of making it. That was Sarah Kelly's dream, and in 1995 it came true. Actor-director Quentin Tarantino asked her to make a documentary about the making of the Robert Rodriguez vampire western From Dusk Till Dawn. Tarantino was the screenwriter, executive producer, and starred in the film along with George Clooney, Juliette Lewis, and Harvey Keitel. Kelly knew Tarantino, having worked as a production assistant on Pulp Fiction. What was going to be a film about a threatened union strike became a funny and revealing look at the life of a film crew. Full Tilt Boogie is about the gossip and the gripes and the aspirations of the people who work endless hours behind the scenes on a movie set. Sarah Kelly has worked on several other films, including Gettysburg, Killing Zoe, and Sleep With Me. I asked her what she learned from watching directors work.
Well, you know, working with Quentin, I worked as a production assistant on Pulp Fiction, and He really makes it look easy. It's sort of like you learn almost from the directors that aren't as savvy what not to do. But in terms of watching Quentin, he is so amazing, and his energy and his inspiration, that it sort of trickles down to the crew, and he really inspires people. And the way he works with actors, I learned a lot with, because he spends a lot of time with them. And I've noticed some directors sort of sit in their chair and look at the monitor. And Quentin doesn't even have a monitor on his sets. He is very one-on-one with the actors and takes a lot of time with them.
And you were looking to do the same, to create that same kind of relationship?
Yeah. You know, I think he pulls out things from within them, and he takes the time to give them backstory and to really get into the characters with the actors. And I think that, unfortunately, that is rare with directors. I've talked to a lot of actors. I used to ask them what they thought made a good director, and they all said, you know, someone who will spend a lot of time with you, just one-on-one.
This, of course, is a documentary, so you're really documenting events as they unfold. That's a different kind of responsibility for a director.
It is, yeah. Well, it's hard because there's no script.
Right.
And there's no rehearsal time, and there's no take-backs. You know, you either get it or you don't get it. And so it was tricky, and you know, we just had to, again, keep our eyes and ears perked for something good that was going to happen, or some terrible disaster that we could capture and roll away.
Were there certain things you did to prepare yourself for that first day as director? You had a good breakfast, for instance?
Yeah, I had a good breakfast, said a lot of prayers. No, you know, I mean, I had sort of been gearing up for it, really, for years, and I had been mouthing off about the fact that I was going to be a director. And so it happened quickly, but that it also, I had been dreaming of it for so long and sort of mentally preparing myself. And when it happened, I was just actually a little bit numb.
Did you have to learn how to give orders?
Yeah, actually, that was probably the hardest thing in the beginning, was because I was so used to following orders that giving orders actually was a whole new ballgame. And my crew was mainly male. Mm-hmm. And so I learned ways in which to communicate to the boys what I wanted. And,
such as?
Well, I used to say in the beginning things like, do you think maybe we could, like, go set up at George Clooney's trailer? And they would just, like, sort of grunt and not listen and then keep eating their lunch. And then I would sort of rephrase it, take a deep breath, and say, after lunch we are setting up at George Clooney's trailer. And they go, oh, okay.
So, a statement, not a question.
Right, yeah. And you have to learn that fine line of between, you know, being bossy and actually just saying, no, I'm the director and I have to lead these people.
Were there questions, issues about you being a woman leading a group of men? Was that something you had to struggle with?
No, not really. I mean, I think just in terms of being aggressive enough to communicate what I wanted. In terms of being a woman, I've actually run into less obstacles than you would think. And I think a lot of it just has to do with whether or not you believe enough in yourself. And I do. And so for me, you know, all the my mentors were mainly men, and they really took me under their wing, and it was never an issue with them.
How about being young? You're in your mid-20s. Was that an issue?
Young was more of an issue, actually, than being a woman. And so sometimes combining that young and a woman, definitely, you sort of have a lot to prove. But young was more of an issue because people think, well, you know, how you don't have all these years of experience under your belt, and what are you doing? You're a kid. So especially when you're known as a production assistant for years, that was kind of a challenge to kind of step up and prove that I had graduated.
I really enjoyed the behind-the-scenes look in this film, and you get a feel for the crew that, of course, never get the face time in a film, and when you see the credits on the screen, they go by so quickly, you can't really digest who they are. But the whole group of people that gravitates towards filmmaking, is there something distinctive about this group?
You know, I think that a lot of times these people love, I think basically they have common grounds, which is they don't want to work in the corporate world. They don't want to work 9 to 5. They're very creative, and they love storytelling, especially in independent film. And I think that they sort of crave this crazy, weird, circus-like atmosphere. And I think that even the Grips, and as it's in Full Tilt Boogie, you know, you can see that they are in it also for the creative aspect of it. So I think it's people who sort of crave that sort of a little bit more exciting life.
There seems like there's a lot of downtime on a set, at least from an outsider. A lot of waiting, a lot of setting up things in a holding pattern, waiting for the sun or the wind to cooperate.
Right.
Does it feel like downtime when you're on the set?
Oh, yeah. They have a saying in the film business called hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
And there are two states. You're either panicking and hurrying to get something, or you're waiting around for hours. And that's where a lot of extracurricular activities develop. So, you know, you get to know people and you play weird games, and you just kind of, you know, there are hours and hours and hours where you're not doing too much. So a lot of relationships form, and that's also a lot where people end up talking and sharing ideas, and there's a lot of sort of creative time that happens there too.
What are some of those extracurricular activities you just referred to?
Well, you know, you can see some of them in Full Tilt Boogie. It's everything from, you know, doing spit takes to talking about who's cute on the set to, you know, a lot of games develop. But you always have to be ready to drop whatever you're doing and get back to work.
Were you good at that as a production assistant, that hurry-up-and-wait business?
At hurry-up-and-wait? Yeah, well, you know, during the waiting time, that's when I kind of used that time to kind of be a sponge and to sort of look around and listen and ask questions and hang out with people that were inspiring. And so that, to me, was the time that I really tried to learn as much as I could.
A lot of time seems to be spent on coffee, food, iced mochas. That's really important in the set, that people are well-fed and well-watered.
It is, yeah. And, I mean, the first rule you learn if you're doing even a film school project or a really low budget is feed your crew. If you don't pay them, you have to feed them. It's more important than money at that on a film set. And, of course, there's also beer involved after shooting.
A lot of beer, right.
Especially on location, and that's important, too. After shooting, but yeah, it really is. It means more to you at the time than money does.
Well, I would assume on every set there are disasters. There are things that happen. There are things that can't be anticipated. And
right.
in this, the making of this film, as you document in your own film, a number of things happen, from union problems to a set that practically burns down. Is that
right.
Something you know it's going to happen? Things are going to happen on a set.
Right. Well, I used to, you know, we used to actually hope that something bad would happen, because in the beginning it just seemed like this was such a wonderful set and everything was so smooth that we would have to have birds chirping in the background and no one would really believe it or be interested. But, you know, I knew that there was going to be union problems, so I sort of anticipated that. And you can't anticipate the set burning down or the dust storm.
Right.
Blowing through. So that was kind of exciting, and I was glad that we were able to capture that.
The union targeted this film. Why?
Why? Because it was a very large budget to have been an independent film. And I think that because it was happening in their backyard, it was an $18 million film. I think that they just felt that was uncalled for and that it was sending a bad message, and that they figured if they had $18 million that they should be spending some of that on health benefits and on union wages. So that was their reason. And I'm, you know, I also do agree with Quentin and Elizabeth Avion and Lawrence Bender and the people I interviewed that are the producers of the film, is that they were also going directly after Quentin and Robert Rodriguez because they are these hotshot independents that made it big. And they came up, you know, from a $7,000 film to an $18 million film. That's what Robert did. And he still likes to work as if he's an independent.
Even if he has $18 million.
Yeah. In other words, he likes to edit his films. He likes to operate the Steadicam. He likes to operate the camera. He sort of does all these things that normally on a union set there would be filled by different people. The positions would be filled by different people. And I think that they wanted an atmosphere that was creatively free, and that wouldn't have been the case if it had been a union show. And so they tried to just pay comparable wages, and then they ended up giving health care in the end, which was good because that was the main issue, I think, that people were really missing out.
So in a sense, the union forced them then to pay good wages and provide for the crew?
Well, actually, they didn't get forced. I mean, when they struck the deals with everybody that signed on to work on the movie, the wages were comparable from the beginning. They were comparable anyway. They were, and basically, you know, as Quentin says in the movie, unions should not come down and strike a set just for the hell of it. You should sort of hear that there's a problem and then investigate the problem and then come down and strike a set. But this was a happy environment of people who wanted to be there, who had been part of the Robert and Quentin family for, you know, four or five films before. And so this was kind of a group of people that had worked together before. They all wanted to be there, and they knew that it was going to remain independent. But in terms of giving health care, I think that the producers went around and said to the crew, if we remain independent, what's the one thing that you really, or what's the most important issue to you? And everybody said health care. So they had to listen to that, and they were able to provide it.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a very short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is director Sarah Kelly. And we're talking about a documentary she just did called Full Tilt Boogie. And it's about the set of a Robert Rodriguez film called From Dusk Till Dawn, a look at what happened in front of the camera and behind it. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Sarah Kelly, and we're talking about her film Full Tilt Boogie, which is a documentary on the making of a Robert Rodriguez film called From Dusk Till Dawn. How many movie romances blossom on the set of a film? Is that pretty common?
It is. You know, it is common, and I don't know about necessarily full-blown romances, but definitely crushes develop, and they develop on very strange people, I think, because you're working these very long hours, and the outside world virtually doesn't exist when you're on a movie set, and so you have all this extra time to sort of think about people, and there's a lot of crushes going on.
There's actually a great scene of a number of the crew sitting around talking about crushes and fantasies and who's doing what with whom. I mean, it sort of just tantalizes us. It doesn't give us a lot of hardcore information. Do you think they were being very circumspect because you were filming them?
I think so, yeah. And I think that actually, you know, I certainly wasn't out to ruin anybody's life, so I didn't want too much dirt. But I also think that a lot of it is just talk and hot air, and that basically it stays at the crush level.
And it kind of helps to pass the time, right?
To talk
about this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you pretty much identify in the first week who's cute. And
right.
It starts to circulate. And it really does help pass the time.
Were there times when making this documentary that certain people didn't want to be interviewed, didn't want to be filmed?
Oh, yeah. And one of those examples is Harvey Keitel, who really didn't want anything to do with Full Tilt Boogie. And we respected that and sort of avoided him on the set as much as we could. And then he finally did allow us to interview him. He allowed Quentin to interview him at his last day of shooting. So that was one example. But there were a lot of people who, for whatever reason, some of the reasons being the union issues, just really didn't want to be involved, didn't want to be on camera. And we really tried to respect that and just tried to sort of avoid shooting them.
Why didn't Harvey Keitel want to be involved and included in this documentary?
You know, I think that the most basic reason is that he is a very serious method actor, and he was really there to be involved in From Dusk Till Dawn. And so he didn't want to waste any of his sort of energies involved in Full Tilt Boogie. And at the time, he wasn't really sure what it was or what it would end up being. And I think that he just decided he'd rather stay away from it.
Okay.
But, you know, then on the other hand, we had George Clooney and Juliet, who were very willing to be a part of both movies.
Well, very much hams, I would say.
Yeah, they were great.
Playing to the camera.
Right.
When the film is over, does a crew get depressed? You put a lot of time and energy into putting a film together.
Yeah, I think that there's a huge amount of depression that happens, especially the very next day, because you've been working with these people for hours and hours and hours and weeks on end, and that's really your whole existence. And then one day, all of a sudden, that's a wrap and it's over. So it's very hard to get used to, and you have to sort of, you think that you can toughen up your skin, but every time it's happened, I know I've gotten depressed. And it's just very weird, because you wake up and you have nothing to do the next day.
How did you get interested in making films in the first place?
Well, I was raised going to films from the time I was six. And so my parents kind of, you know, always took us to movies. And movies were a big part of my life growing up. But it didn't occur to me until the end of college when I took a short film class and kind of said, I didn't know this was an option. And then I actually stumbled into a matinee showing of a film called Slacker. Directed by Richard Linklater. And when the movie was over, I walked out into Santa Cruz and realized the movie was still going on and that he had really done an amazing job of capturing life kind of just as it is. And so I decided that that's kind of what I wanted to do.
Well, I would think a lot of people say that, but what did you do next to make that happen?
Well, there was a man who was a producer, Moctezuma Esparza, who was coming to speak to the film class, and I found out where he was staying and sort of marched into his room and handed him a speech that I had written for graduation and told him to hire me. I actually told him to hire me, and he did. He was, I think, impressed with that confidence, and I told him I could make coffee really well and that I had no experience but that I would be willing to work hard, so... And that was the beginning of my career as a coffee maker.
What was that speech about?
You know, I look at it now, and it was very, it was a very college graduation speech. but it really was talking about taking what you've learned and bringing it out into the world and trying not to forget sort of where you came from. And I talked about making films and painting pictures and, you know, curing diseases and things like that, just sort of trying to take what you've learned and go out into the world and do something with it. And that's what I really wanted to do.
So all that, all those highfalutin ideas plus the ability to make coffee, that was what opened the doors for you?
Very important. Yeah. And, you know, it's actually it's funny because you can just make coffee or you can kind of take it to another level and make coffee, but at the same time also really be a sponge and try and learn as much as you can. And that's really what I tried to do. And I also really loved making coffee. I mean, I knew I wouldn't do it forever, but I, at the time, really felt privileged and happy to be doing it.
And you make a good cup of coffee.
And I do.
Well, Sarah Kelly, thank you very much for joining us at AM Fresh Air, and good luck to you.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Kelly is the director of Full Tilt Boogie, which opened last weekend in New York, Los Angeles, Austin, Dallas, Houston, and Seattle.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I'm wondering what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. Losing control, yeah, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. When you started out with nothing and you pounded, you're a selfie man. And your friends, they all come calling, slap you on the back and say,
coming up, The Fall of a Sparrow. This is Fresh Air. Robert Hellinga's acclaimed first novel, The 16 Pleasures, described the life-altering adventures of an art restorer in Florence, Italy. Hellinga's new novel, The Fall of a Sparrow, has just been published, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says it surely qualifies as a 17th pleasure.
Towards the end of Robert Hellinga's magnificent new novel, The Fall of a Sparrow, the main character finds himself in Rome, staring down at the Colosseum and thinking of how Freud used the city and civilization and its discontents to represent the secretive depths of the human mind. It's too bad Freud so definitively staked his claim on Rome as metaphor, because the city, with its layers upon layers of history, of stories, would also be the perfect symbol for this rich and elusive novel. In The Fall of a Sparrow, Hellinga has pulled off perhaps the most difficult writer's trick of all. He's set down the ungraspable. Hellinga wields a magical language that's not so cryptic as to baffle the reader, and not so plain that it flattens out the essential mystery of the emotions and experiences he's describing. The Fall of a Sparrow is a novel about loss and slow, rending transformation. Our hero, Alan Woodhull, nicknamed Woody, is a classics professor at a small Midwestern college. He and his wife, Hannah, had three daughters. But 7 years before the story proper begins, the oldest daughter, Cookie, is killed when a terrorist group bombs the train station she happens to be sitting in Bologna, Italy. Afterwards, Hannah retreats into religion, eventually divorcing Woody and entering a cloistered convent. Woody turns to his beloved classical authors for solace. The terror of coincidence is the phrase he invokes from Oedipus Rex to try to comprehend Cookie's death. He also turns to Schopenhauer and Plato, but, we're told, he soon realized that they didn't know anything more about death than the authors of self-help books, and they didn't have any practical advice. With the passing of time, Woody has recovered his sense of humor and a degree of happiness. But he's only half alive, a man who doesn't want any more adventures, a man who thought that life had already taught him all the lessons he needed to learn. If I tell you that The Fall of a Sparrow charts how Woody, like Homer's Ulysses, stumbles into those unwanted adventures, quests for adequate words to express his grief, and finally sails home to a measured peace, you might get the wrong impression. You might think that this is one of those ennobling stories that celebrate the inevitable triumph of the human spirit, or some such rubbish. No, I mean for that Ulysses allusion to be taken seriously. For The Fall of a Sparrow really is like a classical epic in its vastness of tone. There's plenty of tragedy and comedy here, as well as frisky passages that describe Woody's affair with an Iranian graduate student, luscious descriptions of Italian banquets, and directions on how to play authentic steel guitar blues. Woody's middle daughter, Sarah, occasionally takes over the narrative, and in her rueful, funny voice, tells us about working as a waitress in Chicago after college and watching, helplessly, as her father voyages out of her reach. As you'd expect in this classically inflected tale, there's also a decisive confrontation here with a monster. After years of delays, the terrorists responsible for Cookie's death are brought to trial. Woody abandons his teaching job to go to Rome and confront the young female zealot who planted the bomb. Their face-to-face meeting in her jail cell is as harrowing as any of Ulysses' deadly rendezvous with Homer's chorus line of she-demons. You don't need to be an oracle, one of Homer's other stock characters, to see that end-of-the-century fever is upon us. We're being deluged with lists of, among other things, the greatest novels of the 20th century. The bias of these lists is usually conservative. By that I mean they implicitly suggest that the best has been, that as we've been hearing for some time now, the novel is dead. Ha! Every time a great new novel, like The Fall of a Sparrow, appears, it renews the form, and its hearty, true voice drowns out the smug mewlings of the literary doomsayers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Fall of a Sparrow by Robert Hellinga. Interviews and reviews on Fresh Air are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Kathy Wolf, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Sue Spolin directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.